This week on New Western Context, Trudeau has yet to account for $600 billion in spending. More needs to be done to end boil water advisories, and Alberta's deficit drops much faster than expected. Also, the CBC tells us the words we shouldn't use while we give context on the history of these words. This is Western Context, episode 247, recorded Friday, December 3rd, 2021, The Context of Words. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are here yet again this week, our first episode of December. We realized last week's show was a little bit absurd, but we are maintaining the traditional Western Context approach this week, but probably not as absurd as last.
Oh, yes, there's been lots of news that has come out this past week that really bears the need to really have a look into it a bit further, because a lot of the times the media kind of just skims over what the headlines are and they don't really go into what is really happening in Canada, which is why we have a whole slate of news this week to talk about what is happening in Canada and why it's important to be aware of that.
That's right. And a lot of the news has its true meaning hidden behind what the media says in the context that they lack. And that's the whole reason the show is named Western Context. In providing that context, we hope to remove all the media bias and sensationalism that you find in the news wherever you get it, and in doing so, we hope to put you guys, our listeners, on the right side of the news. And you can follow along with us in our full show notes at westerncontext.ca. And, of course, you can also find our Patreon page at patreon.com/westerncontext, which we'll talk about in a little while. But we're going to begin in Ottawa this week with a story that really didn't gain too much traction, and it really should have, given the ramifications of it that the Liberal government has when it comes to Canada's finances. The reason this is a big deal is because it was announced this week that Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland will table a fiscal update on December 14th. The fiscal update effectively provides an update to Parliament. It needs to pass a confidence vote, and it is seen by the media as a way of the government updating where they're at on the path to balance, or in the case, as it has been since 2015, the path to an unbalanced, non-balanced budget. And they can do this with the fiscal update without putting forward an entirely new budget. Of course, we'll remember that the first budget we had was tabled earlier this year, the first budget in 20 months, which was a really darn long time for that to happen. But nonetheless, before we have this fiscal update, we need to make it clear that fiscal updates look forward into the future. And there's lots of questions about the finances of the government, particularly what happened to the $600 billion that the government was granted to spend during the pandemic. And the reason we're talking about this is because the fiscal year ended on March 31st, and the public accounts, as they're called, and other documents that show how the government spent money have not been made publicly available yet. Normally, they're made available in October or November. There's been rare cases in the past where they've been tabled in December. But the reason this is so important is because before the MPs take their Christmas break, the government wants to pass further pandemic measures worth a grand total of $7 billion that will have to pass a confidence vote in the House. Now, this week, much of the media coverage has been focused on the passage of the conversion therapy ban that was passed in Parliament, in the last Parliament rather, and then died in the Senate when Justin Trudeau called the late summer election. Now, the Conservatives stepped up and they showed that the Conservative Party is not the old Conservative Party, and it's not them who's going to be the stumbling block in this Parliament, because it was actually the Conservative Party, the official opposition, that motioned to pass this bill without any further debate in the House of Commons, effectively moving it immediately to third reading and sending it to the Senate, which effectively means that going forward, conversion therapy will be banned in Canada. And the reason we're talking about this is because it was a masterful move by the Conservative Party on a number of levels, but most of the media coverage this week has been focused on the passage of that bill, missing this $600 billion in accounting that has to be addressed. And the reason this is so important is because the April budget deficit for 2020-2021 would be $354.2 billion, up from $39.4 billion the previous year. For context, the projected deficit was nearly the same size as the $362.9 billion in total federal spending the previous year, and this is, of course, because of the pandemic. The budget has said, of course, that total spending for 2020/2021 would be $634.9 billion. And you're seeing the problem here. The government hasn't detailed how they spent $600 billion of that $634 billion. The fiscal update and budget looks forward in time, meaning that while we will get updated in just under 2 weeks on what the government finances look like, we won't actually have an eye into what happened in the last fiscal year and how Parliament spent all this money. Former Parliamentary Budget Officer Kevin Page says that the government should release this data because having it from last year can help inform future requests from all the departments going forward, and more importantly, in his view, in his own words, he said that it's all information that can be used to shape the debate and hold the government to account. And as we all know, it was at the very start of the pandemic that the Trudeau Liberal government wanted a blank check to spend freely for 18 months. And looking at this $600 billion, they could have very well got away with it in terms of not being able to account where that $600 billion went or what it was spent on. Now, that's all fine and well in the past. $600 billion, we're living in an era where government workers and people in the federal bureaucracy who are dealing with these budgets aren't going to bat an eye at that. But we also need to look at the $8.7 billion in new spending that the government wants in the current fiscal year. There's a twist on this, though. Normally, these requests are approved by the House of Commons, and when they pass their vote, it's after that they have been reviewed by relevant standing committees, committees based off of each of those different areas. For example, there might be a committee on natural resources, or there might be a committee on fisheries. These committees will review these and provide opinions and review to the government about how they're spending the money. But the twist this time is that this $8.7 billion in new spending money will be reviewed by the Committee of the Whole, as it's called, which means that all MPs on the floor will act as a temporary committee. Now, to the untrained eye, this might seem like that there's more eyes looking at the problem. But this process does not involve calling policy experts or department officials like the standard standing committees do. With the current timing, there will only be days to ask questions once the accounts are tabled, and that's because the House will not return from its Christmas break until January 31st of 2022. With the biggest debt and deficit in Canadian history, the taxpayers, let alone MPs, deserve to know what the heck is going on. The receipts that Canadians have from groceries, Christmas supplies, gas, and home heating all tell a story. And that is if you own a home, because as we know, home prices have risen a lot since 2015, and there's actually a story out this week by this that shows that home prices have risen on average by about 70%. Or $300,000 in this country since Justin Trudeau became prime minister. His 2015 Real Change election saw a call for affordable housing in the cities that the Liberals won. Nobody, of course, saw the pandemic coming, but when you think about it, $600 billion, as we're looking for right now, could build so many houses for people who are struggling with a housing shortage. And that's actually the case because, as has been reviewed by the net average of dwellings available by G7 countries, Canada would need to build 1.8 million more houses to reach the G7 average of 471 dwellings per 1,000 residents. This housing report came from Ryerson University, and while it showcases the huge increase in housing prices, it also confirms what everyone has felt, and that there has been only modest growth in personal incomes with this. So while housing has risen by 70%, nobody has seen their own wages grow by 70%, if anything at all, over the last 5 years. we need to really ask what the true priorities of this government are. And yes, we need to be clear that making priorities is difficult, but when $600 billion can't be accounted for and people can't afford houses, it begins to tell a story about our economy that we're only beginning to realize the impact of. With $600 billion in accounting missing, rising inflation, rising prices, rising house prices, and you think about it, everything rising like a rocket ship going to the moon, we're beginning to realize the true impact of one of Trudeau's favorite quips. And that's, of course, when he said that the budget will balance itself. And as we're all learning, he probably meant that.
Yes, that's exactly it. And for those who are looking at what has been going on with the budgets that Trudeau has put forward, this should come as no surprise, as we've seen in the past with the Canadian Infrastructure Bank that was set up by Trudeau to put money and effort into building public works infrastructure projects. We've seen that in the past that there's been a lack of accounting with the infrastructure bank and that there is billions of dollars that have gone unaccounted for. And you would think that the number one goal of the Canadian Infrastructure Bank would be to create money and to build these projects and get them done. But apparently the number one goal of it is actually to cause money that's been spent on it by the government to go missing, because we have no idea where a lot of the money that the bank has got from the government through taxpayer money has actually gone to. And so when it comes to the budget itself, which is being described as this fiscal update upcoming on December 14th as a minor fiscal update, so it's not even going to have a full accounting of the country's balances that are going forward. And it's not going to be a new budget that's going to be put in place. It's going to be a continuation of all the spending that has been going on the past year. And, you know, the country is going further and further into debt. And we don't really know why. We don't know why the government is spending all this money. We don't know where the money is going. We don't know what projects it's going to be spent on. And for a country that's going further into debt, with inflation on the rise, with personal debt on the rise, and with businesses struggling to stay afloat after disaster of the pandemic, as well as all the other issues that have gone on the past year, well, it's leaving the country in dire straits. And this is something that the government should be more focused on, is trying to reduce the worries of inflation. But with how much debt the country is in on a government level, it's hard to tell exactly how that could happen.
Yeah, and you know, the discussion that will happen in Trudeau-friendly circles and in parts of the media is that, well, it was the pandemic. We should spend on whatever we need to spend on. There should be no limit. And these hybrid sessions of parliament where half the members are virtual and half the members are in person leads us to believe that we're still operating under pandemic protocols, and it's okay to not have all the accounting in place. But the exact opposite is true. It's the biggest budget deficit we've ever seen. There should absolutely be some form of accounting to where the $600 billion was spent. And thinking about it as we head into the future, the fiscal updates are going to address future spending, yes. But we don't know what's going to happen in the past, and hopefully there will be enough time to glean a picture of what the $600 billion was spent on. And hopefully there is nothing suspect, because if there was, then the opposition won't have much time to question it, as Parliament will have gone on their Christmas break. But of course, we're going to move on to our next story here and talk about where the government could be spending some of this money. But before we do that, I'll just remind our listeners about our Patreon page, which you can find at patreon.com/westerncontext. And that's how you can help support the podcast if you enjoy it. For as little as $2 a month, the price of a cup of coffee, you can help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month at the price of a sandwich, you can continue to help us do that and have your name read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. Now, when we reach $30 a month in contributions, patrons will receive an exclusive monthly news article expanding on topical stories of the month and this article will continue to provide the context and information you've come to expect from us. At $60 a month, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month where we reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs are headed next. And of course, we also do have an option to make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, which you can learn more about at westerncontext.ca/support. So with that, we did mention that there was a need to spend money in other places, and this should have very well been a bigger election issue than it was, but we are once again turning to First Nation Reserves water treatment supply questions.
Yes, and one of the biggest promises of the first 5 years of Trudeau's government was to end all of the boil water advisories that have been plaguing First Nations communities for years, some of them even decades. Now, to their credit, they have reduced the number sharply, but there are still dozens of communities still unable to use their own water, and the government has admitted that they will not be able to meet their target of completely eliminating the boil water advisories by the end of their first 5 years. Now, many of the problems have arisen because of a lack of attention and money set aside for the maintenance and operation of the new treatment plants that have been built. And indeed, there has been 60 new water advisories that have come in place just since Trudeau was elected because of the lack of maintenance to existing water treatment plants. Now, Yves Giroux, who is the parliamentary budget officer, has said that the federal government is short a total of $138 million a year to help First Nations maintain the water systems that have been built to eradicate the boil water advisories. Now, the Liberals have not set a new target since reporting that they would not meet their goals, but have since pledged more funding to build and upgrade water treatment plants. Now, the PBO found that those plans have enough funding to build the new plants, but that the government hasn't set enough aside to operate them. Now, the PBO has looked at historical and planned spending to find the gap of $138 million per year. Now, the problem with this is that if these concerns are not addressed swiftly, badly maintained water treatment plants, or in some cases, not staffed water treatment plants, will only become greater future problems as they can deteriorate quicker and drive up overall costs sharply. Now, even new plants can swiftly cause problems if they're not properly taken care of. Now, the Auditor General has also highlighted that the government's commitment did not cover homes on about a third of homes on reserves with private wells or cisterns, or even those with simply no access to running water whatsoever. Now, Crown Indigenous Relations Minister Mark Miller points out that many of the Indigenous communities where the water advisories are in place are small and remote communities, and Miller said that it would be an ongoing challenge to keep those facilities fully staffed because well-trained water technicians were going to be in demand everywhere. Now, Miller highlighted a training program in Manitoba that has been very successful in recruiting and training Indigenous people to work on water treatment plants in their own communities. He said that they hoped that they could keep using programs like this to train more operators, but that it would be an ongoing issue. Miller said, quote, "We just have to have more saturation of those options and to make sure that local folks are trained up to be the pride of their community and operate something that's such an essential asset. Absolutely, it will be a challenge ongoing, but it's something we're willing to meet." Now, it should be noted that reconciliation remains high on the Liberals' agenda, but as they enter their third mandate, they do so facing more scrutiny around what progress has been actually achieved compared to what's been announced in the past. NDP critic MP Laurie Idlout said that the Liberals have said the right things but have failed to deliver. She said, quote, "In a country as rich as Canada, it is unacceptable that so many Indigenous communities are still living under boil water advisories. Many people have never known what it's like to have safe, clean drinking water straight from the tap. The Trudeau government has failed to keep their promise to lift all long-term boil water advisories in Canada by the end of March this year. Indigenous people can't wait any longer." Now, the importance of clean drinking water as a basic human right in Canada cannot be overstated. Even in the cities, poor maintenance and testing of water can lead to boil water advisories. Just this past weekend, the City of Montreal had issued a boil water advisory for several West Island communities following a failed water test. Now, the advisory only lasted for a day, but imagine if it were longer than that, though. Now imagine if it were 5 years instead of just one day. People in Montreal would be up in arms over the issue, and Montreal's Liberal MPs would be hard-pressed to answer for their failure. Now, this is not even mentioning the many communities in BC that have had to deal with weeks-long boil water advisories due to the massive floods that have devastated the province. Now, in the cities, we expect basic amenities to be available to us, such as free glasses of water when you go out for dinner with your friends at a restaurant, or public drinking fountains at schools where kids can go to refresh themselves after a long day of classes, or the ability to refill your water bottle at the gym after you work out. You know, this is a reality that many communities in Canada do not have access to that basic right. Now, ending boil water advisories in Canada should be a bipartisan issue, and all parties should be standing up for Canadians' access to this basic human right. The media should be focusing more on this issue that frequently takes a back seat to all the other comings and goings of the government. So while in the past week the House of Commons pats itself on the back for coming to a unanimous agreement about a ban on conversion therapy that really should have been passed in the last parliament had Trudeau not called an early election, well, maybe media pressure could create unanimous support for people who have been waiting, sometimes decades, for these issues on basic human rights to be solved. Universal access to clean drinking water would be a real step towards reconciliation.
And if you go back even to the 2015 Liberal election platform, the topics of reconciliation were in there, and they've had 6 years to start to deal with it. But lo and behold, we're still dealing with these questions as basic questions of clean drinking water here in the year of 2021, when in reality, we just finished a story that got no coverage in the media. This story also got no coverage in the media. The previous story was talking about a missing $600 billion, and I said this comment in the last story. Imagine how many houses you could build with $600 billion. Imagine what $600 billion could do when it comes to fixing the water supply on the reserves. It's as simple as that, and it does come down to a question of priorities and just the will to get things done. And that's one thing that a lot of people see in their politicians of whichever stripe or color it might be, is that they're always focused on what feels like very traditional aspects, things that they want to do with their term. But nobody ever pushes the envelope. And pushing the envelope is what's needed at this point to fix a lot of the problems that our country sees going forward.
Yes, exactly. This is something that, as I mentioned, could be dealt with on a bipartisan issue. And certainly the NDP have taken notice of this. But it remains to be seen what the other parties think on this. And it's kind of hard to actually search for this yourself when the media doesn't really want to talk about a lot of this sort of thing. And certainly this is something that is worth spending money on. And we would hope to see that the Liberal government continues to follow through on their promise, even if they have missed their own deadline. But, you know, this is something where we wonder where part of that missing $600 billion might have come into play. Would there have been more money for this sort of thing to get fixed long time ago? Would there have been more money to fix other problems or to help disaster relief? Or maybe we'd have a better response against the pandemic in the beginning. You know, this is an issue where a lot of this money can go towards doing certain things if we only knew where it went in the first place. So that's why these few stories are quite related to each other and why it's important to have such good accounting of what's going on, because there's issues such as this that should be fixed immediately and probably should have been fixed a long time ago. But here we are in 2021 and we're still waiting for such things as basic drinking water to be available anywhere in Canada.
Yeah, you're going to need a major disruptor to get these changes done in government, because you look at 6 years and it's clear that they're not going to do it at this point. And it's something that any political party out there could capitalize on. The NDP could, the Conservatives could. It's just a question of having the will to do it. But we'll have to wait and see if any of that materializes itself during the session of Parliament and into the next election campaign in about two years and a bit. But we're going to pivot to Alberta right now. because this week Albertans got some unprecedented good economic news. I want to underscore that, good economic news, because it's been a long time since we've been able to talk about that. And the good economic news is that Alberta's oil output has hit record levels, and the province broke the highest year-to-date production record going back to 2010, which is 85% higher, to be precise. That's almost double. And you have to think back to 2010. That was the last time there was an economic boom. So this is something that the province definitely should be thinking of, and anybody in the energy industry is very proud of this week. And this means that, of course, while our economy grows in new sectors like tech, hydrogen, film, our traditional energy industry is thriving as best as it can. What's more, oil production going into 2025 is forecast to be about 17% higher than it is today. And if we maintain modest prices outside of today's price spike, this will do our province very well. This has also led to a substantial decrease in the provincial deficit. The deficit dropped $12.4 billion to $5.8 billion for 2021-2022. Deficits going forward are forecast to be $3.3 billion and $2.3 billion, maintaining the crude forecast price of about $60 US a barrel. And of course, they could be lower if oil prices stay high. Economic GDP is also expected to grow by 6.1% this year compared to the forecast 4.8%. This is the largest in the country and is largely due to restrictions easing as the pandemic winds down. But of course, there could be questions about the new Omicron variant and whether or not we're at the stage yet where the pandemic will shift to a more endemic response. The plan, of course, for the UCP was always to balance the budget in the first term by bringing spending in line with other provinces, but of course, then the pandemic hit. If the pandemic were to disappear now and the province accelerated its track, the idea of a balanced budget by 2023 isn't hard to imagine at all. The recurring theme in most Alberta stories is that people are shocked when the UCP carries through on an election promise. Their biggest promises, of course, were to get the economy back on track and eliminate the provincial deficit. Barring the pandemic and policies from the federal government that target the natural resources sector, Alberta could be well on its way to enjoying prosperity as we originally saw in 2008 to about 2013. Now, one move that raised eyebrows when the UCP came to office was their cut of corporate taxes. They lowered the corporate tax rate from 12 to 8% by the start of 2021. This was an accelerated process and was only supposed to be complete once we reached January 1st of 2022. But due to the economic downturn, they actually accelerated this. The part that's going to raise a lot of eyebrows is that while overall tax revenues are still down and won't return to pre-cut levels until 2023 or 2024, despite these tax cuts, corporate tax revenues are actually slated to increase by 19%, even with these tax cuts in effect. Finance Minister Travis Toews highlights that these cuts boost investment and raise revenues broadly, which this fiscal update that Alberta tabled actually confirms. Now, of course, the NDP disagrees with the UCP's economic plan in many ways. The NDP finance critic highlighted that tax revenues from personal income tax are slated to rise by $1.4 billion. And of course, with the inflation crisis, that is money that Albertans could instead have in their pockets, and they're entirely right on that. But with an inflation crisis running nationally and wage growth being flat, there is actually an argument to be made that individuals should pay less. This could be done in any number of ways, all of which could potentially be on the table, some of them with a referendum. Some of them could include tweaking the personal income tax scale to be more progressive, which is what the NDP would prefer and do. The province could lower taxes, income taxes, that is, and add a sales tax. That sales tax would likely have to face a provincial referendum. The province could reinstate the flat income tax rate, or once the budget is balanced, they could take a page out of the Ralph Klein playbook or the current Alaska playbook and offer prosperity dividends. The modern economy, when shut down, operates largely on psychology, and if that general collective mood of an industry or a country as a whole is good, that sector, the entire economy of the country, will do well. This falls apart, of course, when limitations are put in place, such as restrictive policies or the government of the day, raises questions about the investment environment, as happened under the NDP here in 2015, or is now happening federally under the Justin Trudeau administration. The reason we're talking about these economic numbers is that they tell two stories. The first is that the UCP's goal to increase investment and stimulate the economy through free market principles worked, and no one should be surprised that they did this, as this was an actual election promise that they kept. Secondly, if not for the pandemic and the Trudeau administration policies, Alberta would be in a similar place to where we were in 2009. That is a major economic boom. Alberta is doing well right now, leading the country in terms of growth, but the economy could still be doing better, barring a few small changes.
It's nice to see a government that can actually follow through on their plans to reduce the deficit, and certainly there is more work to do, but it's much better than it could be, of course, and I think that a government living within its means should be something that is more of a model for what other governments should be doing. And for a lot of people that live in Alberta, that might come as a surprise that the UCP is living in within its means a bit more. But this is something that governments should be doing across the board. Whether you agree with the UCP's policies or not, you can always say that they will follow through on their promises. And this is just another one that they've done. And when it comes down to it, that's something that is going to be key for getting out of this inflation crisis and being able to get the government out of it as well, because they're not immune to inflation as well. And certainly a government that is carrying less debt and deficit will be able to not have to pay near as much as interest rates. And as interest rates begin to climb again, that'll be something that will be worrying for the federal government and other provincial governments that have not done the same due diligence with their own deficit. So this is a good story to see that is happening, and we'd hope to see that this will continue as we go forward.
Yeah, this is the time for governments to be smart and not be losers, because with proper economic management, the way the energy prices sit currently, Alberta is reaping the benefit of this. There is no doubt that the reason the deficit went down is because of the energy prices. But had the federal government enabled that and been a bigger partner in that, the federal government could have been reaping these bonuses in bigger ways too with this. And this comes down to smart economic management, and anybody who doesn't see this needs to have a look at the way economics works, because at the end of the day, this is a blueprint that could be employed by any of the resource producing provinces and should actually be employed by the federal government, because it is about living within the means and utilizing the resources and the tools you have on the table. That is a natural resources industry that has a good amount of value in it right now. Perhaps the prices are artificially high coming out of the pandemic, but this is the time to be reaping those benefits. And anybody who doesn't see that or doesn't understand that is seriously selling themselves and the country short. So this is a story that is probably a bit of a surprise to people outside of Alberta, but it's definitely not a surprise that the Alberta UCP is using this as a way to lower the budget deficit and get back to that point of balance as we move forward and hopefully move out of the pandemic. But of course, we're going to turn now to our firing line and talk about a story that the CBC published involving 18 words, but I'll leave it at that.
Yes, and for those of our listeners who've been listening to this show so far and have been thinking, well, we've been talking a bit too much about economics and a bit too much about money and inflation, all the other things that you want to get away from these days. Well, this next story is not about any of that, because it's about our language and the words we use and how those can come across to different people. And well, it's time to listen up, because the state-funded broadcaster CBC has come up with an article to tell you what words you should and shouldn't use. in a news article titled "Words and Phrases You May Want to Think Twice About Using" that serves as an opinion article without actually having the word opinion attached to it. Therefore, it's labeled as a news article. Well, along with that, there's a handy early 2000s era word cloud that lists all of the supposedly repugnant and racist phrases in bold, colorful letters, just in case you didn't see them in the article themselves. Now, CBC Ottawa says that they have compiled this small list of words, as they say, submitted by readers and CBC journalists who are Black, Indigenous, and people of color, and then they ran them by anti-racism and language experts who say that some of these phrases can be hurtful to various groups of people for their historical and cultural context. And they're not really going after the words that most people would think of as being racist terms, but some of the words in question they're talking about are first world problems, spirit animal, blind spots, spooky, using the word brainstorm, or lowest on the totem pole, or grandfathered in, or savage, or dumb, lame, and tone deaf, and there's many other words and phrases that the article talks about that really shouldn't be used in this day and age anymore. Now, top of the list is anything that includes the root word black. According to the CBC's article, quote, readers and some of our journalists who are Black, Indigenous, and people of color, words like blackmail and phrases like black sheep should be placed on the blacklist, except we shouldn't use the term blacklist either. It should be called a denialist. The article pointed out that the tech industry is now moving away from using the words whitelist and blacklist, replacing it with terms like blocklist or denialist. And computer code labels like master and slave are also being reexamined. And one of the anti-racism experts says, quote, if we use the words allow list instead of whitelist, or to use the word denialist, it enhances the true understanding of that word. But never mind that the article doesn't actually go over the origin of the word that actually doesn't have anything to do with black people whatsoever. The word blackmail, for example, originated in 16th century Scotland, when those living on the border with England were often forced to pay money in order to avoid being raided and pillaged. Legitimate rent was paid in silver, also referred to as white rent or white money, whereas the bribes were often paid in goods and services, hence the opposite term, black rent, which later got turned into blackmail. Now, likewise, the phrase black sheep simply refers to less common sheep with black wool, which sticks out in a herd of white sheep, which is a bit more common. It has nothing to do with black people, and no one who uses the phrase black sheep in common parlance is intending to disparage those with darker skin. But apparently none of that matters, because according to professional anti-racism trainer Joseph Smith, black is more than just a shade. It, quote, connotes evil, distrust, lack of intelligence, ignorance, and lack of beauty, the absence of white. And this is from one of the language experts that the CBC went to as to say why words that have the word black in it are not good words to use. So by making those connections, it could be argued that the anti-racism lobby is actually doing more to roll back all the progress that has been made than actual racists are, by saying that any words that have the words black or white in it are racist. It's actually doing more harm to society by not explaining the origins of these actual words. But as we so often know, in a society that's guided by these critical race theorists, we're all racists even if we don't know it yet. Aya Taniguchi, who is a linguist and an associate language studies professor with the University of Toronto, Mississauga, says that, quote, being an English speaker doesn't entail that you necessarily know the racist etymology automatically. The fact that you said it, oblivious to the etymology, does not automatically make you a bad person. As language users, we have the social responsibility to monitor the impact that our utterances have on others, especially when it involves a marginalized group. And in taken in a vacuum, that, quote, does make a lot of sense. We need to be aware that the words that we say have power and they have meaning, especially when we're using them to describe things that are different than what they were originally intended as. So we have to be aware of the words that we say. That's all fine and well and dandy, but the article then goes on to talk about a bunch of other different words that have no meaning and no connotation when it comes to race whatsoever, but in a sense, they're still being studied for those very tenuous grasps on what the article is trying to say. So it's not apparently just people that are racist, so is the rest of the universe, because Cornell University, which is a top-flight Ivy League university located in New York, is offering a course called Black Holes, Race in the Cosmos. The course description asks the very interesting question, quote, "Surely there can be no connection between the cosmos and the idea of racial blackness. Can there? Contemporary black studies theorists, artists, fiction writers implicitly and explicitly posit just such a connection." So, and by trying to make a connection between the term black hole and an idea of racial connotation that exists in the United States, well, it begs the question as to why exactly they're going that way, because as we all know, the universe doesn't really care about what happens on Earth. Only we really care what happens on Earth, and the gravity of a black hole is so strong that not even light can escape it. Thus, matter, unless matter is actively falling into it, a black hole appears as completely black. To suggest that the term has anything to do with the slave trade or systemic racism is right up along there with the dumbest things that have ever been said. Now, speaking of dumb, that's another word that's on the CBC's censorship list, as is lame. Even a journalist acknowledges that the terms are used to describe a lack of intelligence or something that's boring or unexciting, respectively, but it tries so very hard to actually push that using those words furthers an ableist agenda and should be using words such as disabled or differently abled instead of the words lame or dumb. Now, even terms that were once staples of the left-wing lexicon are now not being able to use anymore, such as the words first world problems, which is a phrase which has been commonly used to imply that none of our problems in Canada really matter because there are people starving in Africa or being slaughtered in the Middle East or, you know, all the other problems that go on elsewhere in the world. And, well, it's classist, so it has to go. So does spirit animal, which is something only ever comes out of the mouths of young people that are trying to find some commonality with something else that is going on. And apparently this has been very common lately, but apparently that's cultural appropriation of real spirit animals with First Nations, so it's being said that you shouldn't use that as well, as is anything else that could refer to Indigenous cultures, such as lowest on the totem pole, because that's being described as culturally appropriating the totem pole. Or savage, which was a word that was used to describe the indigenous peoples of America by European settlers. Even if you use the savage to refer to something else, such as a savage animal or a bear attack being savage or a savage act of terrorism, you can't use the word savage to describe anything other than it being described as the indigenous peoples because, well, that's apparently racist to do so. So even the word tribe is on the list, even though it's part of the official names of many indigenous bands and was actually used to describe the 12 tribes of Israel long before explorers ever came to the Americas in the first place. Another term that was mentioned in the article was the word ghetto, which was originally used to describe the Jewish quarter of 16th century Venice and later to denote areas where Jews were forced to live in Nazi-occupied Europe. Nowadays, terms like ghetto and inner city are commonly associated with impoverished black neighborhoods in the United States, which is racist, even though such neighborhoods exist and are often described as ghettos by those who live in them. So, at the end of the day, words do matter, but more than that, context matters, and that's why we are here to give you the context and the history of these words and what they actually mean when the CBC and others will not do so.
And another thing that we look at when we look at these stories, a lot of the discussion that happens around words and the usage of words so often seems to center around a perceived view of what is acceptable. And we have heard time and time again that we need to view the world as one of not just people not conforming to our own cultural identity, but one of the common things people say is that there's many different cultures out there and people need to be respectful of them. But when it comes down to it, at the end of the day, each one of these cultures is going to use different words. And anybody who has a broad group of friends, a broad community, will know that depending on which culture you poke your head into, there will be different words used in these communities. And there's some of these words that are still used by these communities out there. And for the CBC to go out and write an entire story and say we shouldn't be using these words, it really highlights where their current priorities lie with this. And that, yes, we need to understand that there is a meaning that can be inferred from these words, but at the same time, anybody who strikes up a relationship, strikes up a conversation with somebody, you will have that basis of relationship with them. And they'll know that if you're using any of these words around them, that based on your own personal character, it's generally not something that you're using on these words that you're just trying to be racist, for example. But at the end of the day, it ultimately does come down to a question of what everybody and what each individual person is going to be comfortable with.
Yes, exactly. And when it comes down to it, a lot of these words that are used today have no definition towards what could be described as the racist connotations that a lot of other people might think that it does. For instance, the phrase grandfathered in is being described in that CBC article as dating back to the 19th century policy of the grandfather clause, which stopped Black Americans from voting by limiting eligibility to only those whose ancestors could vote. And by saying, and nowadays it refers to different things that may have new rules that will accept, give an exemption to a certain sort of people that may apply to before the rule existed. And this actually didn't date back to Jim Crow laws in the United States. It's actually dated back much further than that, to the Middle Ages, which was more of a grandfather principle, where the original King Henry II of England said, well, let it be as it was on the day of my grandfather's death, which is a principle by which he said that all of the royal grants that had been made in the previous 9 years were null and void, and he wanted to make it as it was before that. And so this was a term that had originated much earlier than slavery. And as we've said, words change their meaning as time goes on. Certain words get reclaimed, and definitely the word culture, especially amongst young people, has changed the words of their meanings as time goes on, and certainly words do that over the centuries. So while grandfathered in may not have mean something back in the Middle Ages, it meant something different in the United States in the 1800s, and it certainly means something different today entirely. So that's why it is important to actually go through these, because all of the words that the CBC article has pointed out as being fundamentally racist, they're not really going through the true history of what the words actually mean and what they mean nowadays. And what a word is used nowadays can mean something different from what it was back then. And it really comes down to the context given by a particular meaning. And that's why context is so important, and that's why we call ourselves Western Context, and why we always try to give that context to what is going on. Because, you know, if we don't have that context, it's hard to know what the news really is. And that really brings us into our word of the week, which is etymology, which is the study of the origin of words and the way in which their meanings have changed throughout history. And if we look at any of these specific words, we can really see that they have changed quite a bit throughout history, and that the words as used today don't really mean the way that they were originally intended to. And in a sense, they have been reclaimed, and they have shown that they have different meanings to what is going on in the present day as opposed to what they did in the past. So people who study etymology and people who are a fan of words and languages will know that words have changed, and that's why it's important to look at the history of what's going on, be aware of what the words you're using, what they mean, and, you know, to be respectful of other people, because in the end of the day, we need more respect for common people and the people that are around us. And, well, we also need the context necessary to put us on what the news is actually saying.
Yeah, and packing this all up together and tying it all off, it's pretty suspicious that CBC would go down this path, and anybody who looked into the history of these words would learn exactly what we learned here on this firing line. And it's a shame that CBC didn't do that. But then again, that's the whole reason this podcast exists. And if you want full show notes for these, you can find those at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to the podcast on any number of podcast listeners out there. We're on Apple, Pocket Casts, Google, Stitcher. Just find it at westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And of course, we're also on social media on Twitter and Facebook at Western Context. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
Well, we'll always be sure to look through all the news stories that the media talks about and the news that they're not talking about and the context that they're not giving you in deciding what the news is actually about. And we'll be able to give you that knowledge to put yourselves further on the correct side of what's actually going on and to give you the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we'll be back next week for an episode of Western Context.